everyone, this is Mina 007 back for Vassals of Kingsgraves, Agatha Christie linear reread. And I have a touch of a cold, so apologies if I don't sound as clear as I normally do. Today, it is episode 42. We are discussing Mrs. McGinty's Dead, also known as Blood Will Tell. This is a book that stars both Hercule Poirot and Ariadne Oliver. And the plot setup is as follows. Superintendent Spence visits Hercule Poirot to ask him to find evidence that would forestall the execution of James Bentley, who has recently been convicted of killing his elderly landlady, Mrs. McGinty, for a meagre £30 of savings stashed under her floorboards. So yes, shock horror, this is indeed Hercule Poirot investigating the death of a working-class woman by a working-class man. Quite a rarity in Agatha Christie novels. It's a really fascinating opening to the novel because the apparent murderer is not an attractive person. He is surly, he is uninterested, he frustrates Hercule Poirot, who feels that he's not even taking his own innocence as something that he should fight for. But that, in a sense, is what convinces Hercule Poirot that there might be merit in the case. We've seen Agatha Christie in a few novels assert that murderers are arrogant and cocky, and if you leave them to it, they will talk and they will tell you about their murder. This is something that's brought to the fore in Crooked House, where the old man, the very senior man in Scotland Yard, gives his theory about murderers too. This is Superintendent Spence on James Bentley. Quote, "For one thing, you know, he wasn't cocky. Not cocky at all. And in my experience, they usually are. Always so damn pleased with themselves. Always think they're stringing you along. Always sure they've been so clever about the whole thing. And even when they're in the dock and must know they're for it, they're still in a queer sort of way getting a kick out of it all. They're in the limelight. They're the central figure, playing the star part, perhaps for the first time in their lives. They're, well, you know, cocky." Spence brought out the word with an air of finality. So poor James Bentley is not cocky. He's a total non-entity. He's unprepossessing, and there's a strong hint that he's been convicted because the jury just don't like him because he's not attractive or charismatic. So that's the plot setup. Something about the novel's title, though. This is basically one of the nursery rhyme books, like Hickory Dickory Dock or Five Little Pigs. It's not a nursery rhyme that I think is in common use these days, but it's named after a children's game, a little bit like the Hokey Cokey, and it is explained in the course of the novel. The other notable thing about this book is that this really is the start of the pairing of Ariadne Oliver and Hercule Poirot. We have, of course, met her before in Cards on the Table in 1936, but this novel is published in February 1952, so there has been something of a gap. And from now on, she's going to appear more and more with Poirot, and that is seen by a lot of people as the start of a new phase, or the final phase, really, of the Poirot books. In terms of the social change that we have been charting through these novels, remember that Agatha Christie herself is now in her early 60s, and we are still only 7 years after the end of the war. There's a lot of comment about the post-war housing shortage and the rent regulations and restrictions that dole out housing to people who want it. What about the cottage? Did they get that? It was rented. Of course, under the Rent Restrictions Act, the landlord couldn't get the old woman out. But now she's dead. I don't think the niece could have taken over anyway. She and her husband didn't want to. They've got a small modern council house of their own, of which they are extremely proud. That's Superintendent Spence discovering what happened to the cottage that Mrs. McGinty was living in. And so you can see that the woman had right of tenure, which is incredibly important under the Rent Restriction Act. So that means that the landlord couldn't put up rents to market level. And also that her niece, who has inherited her aunt's worldly goods, doesn't want the house anyway because she's been given a council house. So this was social housing built by the government after the war to house the many people who were in need of it. And it still exists in England, although the rate of construction started to decline very rapidly in the 1980s, so it's more of a rarity. But in this period, the incredible springing up of council housing would have been a big and remarkable social change, and it's interesting to see Agatha Christie pointed out. And maybe it is one of the advantages of having a book that is more concerned with the doings of ordinary working class people, because you get more of that social change. Of course, we are still in the world of rationing. I don't know why I say of course. I find it phenomenal that, you know, almost 7 years after the end of World War II, there are still such restrictions on what people can buy in England. Here's a quotation. Someone rang you up, called Maureen from the kitchen as Poirot entered the house. Rang me up? Who was that? He was slightly surprised. Don't know, but I jotted down the number on my ration book. So, although the war's over, it's still very much impinging on people's lives. The other major part of this is that war destroys and disrupts credentials. We got into this a lot with a murder is announced, where if you move into a village, it's not clear that anyone knew you or knows you to recommend you, and you can claim that war records and all sorts of things have been destroyed in the war. Here's a quotation. You know what things are nowadays. The war stirred up everyone and everything. The approved school where Lily Gamble was and all its records were destroyed by a direct hit. Then take people. It's the hardest thing in the world to check on people. Take Broughtony. The only people in Broughtony we know anything about are the Summerhayes family, who have been there for 300 years, and Guy Carpenter, who's one of the engineering carpenters. All the others are, what shall I say, fluid. Dr. Rendell's on the medical register, and we know where he trained and where he's practiced, but we don't know his antecedents. So this is a theme that comes across in Agatha Christie in all of her post-war novels, or certainly all of them to date, that village life, which one might have seen as very stable and secure because people knew all about each other, all about their antecedents, maybe too much about each other because of all the village gossip, that suddenly now there's an unmooring and you can't really be sure people are who they say they are. Okay, so let's get into the events of this novel. The prior novel that we discussed was They Came to Baghdad, that was published in March 1951. This was published in March 1952, so a year later. What had been happening in the world of the readers as they received this book? In April 1951, the Treaty of Paris is adopted, establishing the European Coal and Steel Community, and that's going to become eventually the modern-day European Union. Truman dismisses General MacArthur for his prosecution of the Korean War. In May 1951, the British spies Guy Burgess and Donald Maclean leave the United Kingdom and defect to the Soviet Union. And in May, also, The Goon Show is first broadcast on the BBC Home Service, so bringing to prominence amazing comedians Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan and Harry Secombe. In July 1951, King Abdullah I of Jordan is assassinated by a Palestinian while attending Friday prayers in Jerusalem. He is succeeded by his son, King Talal. In August 1951, Chinese communist forces move into Lhasa, the capital of Tibet. In October 1951, Prime Minister Liaquat Ali Khan of Pakistan is assassinated. And the state of war between the United States and Germany is officially ended. Phenomenal. The war ended in 1945. I'm always shocked by how long these formal peace treaties take. In November 51, Churchill is re-elected in the United Kingdom. And in December 1951, a state of emergency is declared in Egypt due to increasing riots. At some point that year, Greggs opened its first store in Gosforth, Newcastle-upon-Tyne. Greggs, for those listeners in England, will be very famous as a mass market chain of eateries providing sausage rolls and Cornish pasties and sandwiches. Amazing that it started so long ago. Moving to 1952, in February, Princess Elizabeth visits Kenya, where she hears of the death of her father, King George VI, at only age 56. So she becomes queen and takes the name Elizabeth II. And in March 1952, the month of publication of this book, General Fulgencio Batista retakes power in Cuba in a coup. The United States Senate ratifies a peace treaty with Japan. And Konrad Adenauer, who is the Chancellor of Germany, survives an assassination attempt. So what I take from all of that is World War II is being wrapped up with peace treaties, but that this is a very unstable period where we see assassinations and coup attempts, that middle boundary of decolonizing nations, of places on the liminal edges of capitalism versus communism, are seeing real violence and instability politically. And that political instability is stretching nearer to home with the assassination attempt on Konrad Adenauer. So we have peace, we are no longer at war, but the Cold War is sporadically kicking up hot war, and it's a very unstable time where things haven't really settled back and cannot really settle back to what they were before World War II. All of that, I think, very much suits the mood of this book, which, along with many of these post-war Poirot's I find to be much darker, much more sour in tone, with characters which are much less likeable. The light-hearted humour has gone, it feels like a very unsettled time, and Poirot is more and more seen as anachronistic. Maybe he's not even famous, the youngsters don't know who he is. Maybe he's not relevant for this unstable post-war world. So let's get into the characters of this novel. Our investigating team are Superintendent Spence, an old friend of Poirot's, who appeared in Taken at the Flood, another rather sour post-war novel, and asks him to look into the case. We have Hercule Poirot himself, our famous Belgian detective. But he feels melancholy and old and increasingly irrelevant. Here's a passage which I think is rather tragic. If only, he thought, Sir Cher Hastings were available. He dwelt with pleasure on his remembrances of his old friend. My first friend in this country, and still to me the dearest friend I have. True, often and often did he enrage me. But do I remember that now? No. Sidebar from me. Of course he remembers it because he's mentioning it. I remember only his incredulous wonder, his open-mouthed appreciation of my talents, the ease with which I misled him without uttering an untrue word, his bafflement, his stupendous astonishment, when he at last perceived the truth that had been clear to me all along. So share, share, ami. It is my weakness, it has always been my weakness, to desire to show off. That weakness Hastings could never understand. But indeed it is very necessary for a man of my abilities to admire himself, and for that one needs stimulation from outside. I cannot, truly I cannot, sit in a chair all day reflecting how truly admirable I am. One needs the human touch. One needs, as they say nowadays, the stooge. I mean, that's just brilliant, isn't it? It sums up everything that Hannah would hate about Poirot insofar as he treats Hastings so very badly and contemptuously, even as he loves him. But it struck me reading this that it's also quite similar to Spence's description of murderers, that they're cocky, and how Hercule Poirot in some respects shares the cockiness of the murderers that he prosecutes. But yes, poor Poirot, he is melancholy for the delight and admiration of Hastings because he is not as well known by the younger generation. Here is a quotation. His name, he noticed with chagrin, made no particular impression on her. The younger generation, he could not but feel, was singularly lacking in knowledge of notable celebrities. Isn't that marvellous? Poor Poirot, irrelevant. Now let's get to the murder victim. Mrs. McKindy is a charwoman, so she's a housekeeper, basically a cleaner, for many of the families in the village that she lives in, including the Rendles, the Upwoods, the Weatherbys, and the Carpenters. She has a tenant, James Bentley, who is wrongly convicted of her murder. Next we have Bessie Birch, who is Mrs. McGinty's niece. They weren't particularly close, but Bessie inherits her property and, as we heard before, has a very nice council house. I think Hercule Poirot's inherent social conservatism with a small c is shown by the following quote where he very much approves of good housekeeping. Quote, a good wife who kept her house clean and took the trouble to cook for her man. He approved. She was prejudiced and obstinate, but after all, why not? I think that's really funny, and probably not an attitude shared by Agatha Christie, who was very much a professional woman. Bessie has a husband, Joe Birch, and really they exist to allow Hercule Poirot to go through Mrs. McKinty's things. They're not a major part of the plot, and as we know, they're eliminated very early on, because the only property she really has is the house. They don't want it. They have their own council house. So they're there to give the plot point on which the investigation proceeds, which is that in all of Mrs. McGinty's things, she had wrapped some up in newspaper, and Hercule Poirot notices that she's cut out an article. And when you read through that article, you realise that a tabloid newspaper has run a story, Where Are They Now?, about murderesses and their children, and that Mrs. McGinty probably saw from one of these pictures of a child when it was young the reflection of someone who was now living in the village and was attempting to blackmail them. So what Poirot has to do is use the article and try and figure out who in the village could be someone that had a motivation for killing Mrs. McGinty because they were going to expose their rather sordid background. Before we get to the characters in the village, we also have Pamela Horsfall, who's the editor of the Sunday Comet. This is another one of Agatha Christie's rather butch characters after a murder is announced. Miss Horsfall was, quote, tall, manly-looking, a hard drinker and smoker, and it would seem, looking at her, highly improbable that it was her pen which had dropped such ... on the article. She's interesting, actually, because she admits that these tabloid journalists aren't always accurate and just make stuff up, which is going to be significant. And also, before we get to the village, let's talk about Mr. Scuttle, who used to employ James Bentley, And more significantly, Maud Williams, who was a co-worker of James Bentley and seems to be the only person who took an interest in him, and she seems to be a very spunky sort of go-getter young girl, and his only friend, really. We also have Ariadne Oliver, who isn't really so much an investigator in this novel, but she is someone who's staying with the Upwoods because Roger Upwood is adapting a play that based on a book that she's written. And I think here we get some of the real comedy, because I think this is very much probably Agatha Christie describing how she felt about the process of adapting novels. Quote, "It's not like that at all," said Mrs. Oliver. "So far, it's pure agony. Why I ever let myself in for it, I don't know. My books bring me in quite enough money. That is to say, the blockbusters take most of it. That is to say, the bloodsuckers take most of it." Quote, "This is now from me. That's probably the tax man. Now back to the quotation. "And if I made more, they'd take more, so I don't overstrain myself. But you've no idea of the agony of having your characters taken and made to say things that they would never have said and do things they never would have done. And if you protest, all they say is that it's, quote, good theatre. That's all Robin Upwood." There's also a very funny passage which one can take to mean Agatha Christie mocking the idea that she chose to make her detective Belgian. "How do I know?" said Mrs. Oliver crossly. "How do I know why I ever thought of the revolting man? I must have been mad. Why a Finn when I know nothing about Finland? Why a vegetarian? Why all the idiotic mannerisms he's got? These things just happen. You try something and people seem to like it and then you go on. And before you know where you are, you've got someone like the maddening Sven Hyacinth tied to you for life. And people even write and say how fond you must be of him. Fond of him? If I met that bony, gangling, vegetable-eating Finn in real life, I'd do a better murder than any I've ever invented." So there you go, a lovely bit of meta-text from Agatha Christie's Ariadne Oliver. Okay, so I think we've done all the characters who aren't based in Broadhinny, the village. Let's get into the people who are in the village, of whom Hercule Poirot has to figure out who Mrs. McKinty was blackmailing. First of all, we have Maureen and Johnny Summerhayes, who are a couple who lived in India during the Raj. He was a British army captain. They would have had many servants, lived a very luxurious life. And as many people after Indian independence have come back to England and find that they are, after all, only middle class and they have to make do. So they've converted their country house into a guest house. Maureen's absolutely hopeless at it. You know, she can barely cook a decent meal. At the end, Poirot has to teach her how to eat an omelette. She's bleeding all over the green beans and her house is in utter chaos. And Johnny just seems like the classic sort of colonial sort of major general that at some point Agatha would have rather admired. But around the time of Colonel Arbuthnot in Orient Express, I feel she sort of thinks of them as anachronistic and rather stupid. So those are the Summerhays. We then have Dr. and Sheila Rendell, who's the doctor in the village, basically, and his sister. And then we have the Weatherbys, who are quite interesting, actually. So Roger Weatherby is a very overbearing father, and his wife Edith is a kind of faux invalid. It's hinted that we don't really know just how incapacitated she is, so maybe she is running around the village after all. And then they have, or Roger has a stepdaughter, Deirdre Henderson, so Mrs. Weatherby's daughter from the first marriage. And she's actually quite fond of James Bentley. She's another one of these Agatha Christie children who is not really a child, she's a young woman, but has been infantilized and oppressed. You can see similar types in Evil Under the Sun, The Moving Finger, but she's got something to her, actually, so that's rather interesting. Then we have Robin and Laura Upwood. So Robin Upwood is the playwright who is adapting Ariadne Oliver's play. He lives with his mother Laura, who is wheelchair bound, and a very expensively decorated, beautiful house. And then finally we have Guy and Eve Carpenter. She's formerly Mrs. Selkirk. He is rich and has no apparent taste. They live in a very modern house, newly constructed in the village. He got his money from construction and is now going into politics. So they're very much the new money, as opposed to, I suppose, maybe the Summerhays would be the old money, or at least the old house. So you've got those four families in the village, and really they're going to be the focus of Poirot's investigation. How does this book hold up to modern readers? Is it progressive or regressive? Well, I've just said that Poirot himself is rather regressive. Almost everyone in the village refers to foreign help and foreigners with a disparaging tone. Evidently, there must be a lot of refugees still in England who are being used in roles beneath their skill set to do basic manual work. There is lots of classism. For instance, James Bentley doesn't take up with Maud Williams because he thinks his mother wouldn't have approved. This is what he says. Well, you see, I've never had much to do with girls, and she isn't quite what you'd call a lady, is she? Oh, very nice and all that, but I couldn't help feeling that Mother would have thought her common. Is that what you think matters? Again, James Bentley flushed. Her hair, he said, and the kind of clothes she wears. Mother, of course, was old-fashioned. It's just really horrible and condescending and presumably a very good reflection of the times and sort of working class versus middle class versus upper class. Not something we often see in Agatha Christie because we're not often dealing with many working class characters, but the snobbery here is unmistakable. And then, as we know that identity is something to be questioned in this novel, I hope the following isn't a spoiler, but this is yet another one of Agatha Christie's novels where her own attitudes towards adoption can seem very unpleasant and regressive. But this is something that is reflected in Agatha's own life. So her mother, Clara Bomer, was put up for adoption by her, basically Agatha's grandmother, Polly. And it left Clara with a deep lack of self-confidence and really scarred her, I think, and gave Agatha the impression that no matter how hard it was for a mother or a parent to keep a child, and no matter how the temptation to have the child put up for adoption, they shouldn't do it. And this is expressed by one of the characters. I'm not going to reveal who, because I think that is a spoiler for the plot. Quote, my mother parted with me and I had every advantage, as they call it. And it's always hurt, always, always, to know that you weren't wanted, that your mother could let you go. So there we are. Let's now talk about the adaptations of this novel. So the first was a film made by MGM in 1964 called Murder Most Foul. And it replaces Hercule Poirot with Miss Marple, portrayed by Margaret Rutherford. And I watched this for the first time yesterday. And I have to say, I hadn't ever seen one of these Margaret Rutherford Marples. And I know that they're very controversial because they really monkey about with plot. But I actually found it really rather fun. And I thought her incredibly compelling as a screen presence. And it is very different from Mrs. McKinty's Dead. It starts off with James Bentley being convicted. Well, he isn't convicted, actually, because Miss Marple is one of the jurors and she evidently doesn't believe the evidence. So it's a mistrial or a hung jury. And then she decides to go back to the village he's from to try and investigate what really happened. She discovers that Mrs. McGinty is actually an actress in a small provincial theatre company and infiltrates it and starts to investigate the murder. We still have the blackmail plot and the idea that someone's identity has been obfuscated, and you come to the sort of the same or similar conclusion, but the entire plot mechanics and the murder are completely different. So I think it does kind of stand on its own merits. I think it's a great sort of bit of fun to watch, but evidently it's nothing like the book. If you want something that's incredibly faithful to the book, you can watch the 2007 David Suchet ITV Agatha Christie Poirot. It's got a really fantastic cast, including Sean Phillips as Laura, one of the great actresses of our times, and Zoe Wanamaker as Ariadne Oliver, who I think is always great fun. It's incredibly faithful to the novel, so this is the one you should watch. But it is, I think, rather like the novel, rather sour, rather bleak, rather dark. I found this quite a tough novel to read because the plotting all makes sense. Like, I believed the plotting, like the mechanics all make sense, but I just think everyone's just so unlikable, not least James Bentley himself. Anyway, I hope that you do enjoy reading this novel. I think it's probably better regarded than I have described it. I mean, for me, it's probably second-tier Christie and certainly second-tier Poirot. By the time you get into the 50s, you are seeing a little bit of a drop in quality and a lot of the plots are becoming more recycled. Our next novel will be They Do It With Mirrors, which was also published in 1952, but November of that year, and is arguably maybe better regarded. So I hope you sort of tune in next time for that one. But stay tuned after the end credits music if you would like to hear more about the solution to this novel and indeed the clues. So the solution to this novel is that Mrs. McGinty was a snoop. This is the key thing that Hercule Poirot finds when he revisits. We're told that she looks at people's letters, that she listened at doors, but was a very good cleaner. And we also know that she had kept the newspaper article and was blackmailing someone about their faked identity. So some of the clues are, why was the weapon not found? ink and excitement at the post office. The Sunday Comment article is riddled with errors. One of the four women or children is in the village. Maud worked in London, so why come here to this village to live and work? How wheelchair-bound is Laura? That we find out that Maureen and Robin are adopted. That Evelyn can be a boy or a girl's name, which is, of course, shades of Pip in A Murder is Announced. Which, of course, is a clue that is also in A Murder is Announced, where a unisex name is very crucial. We also know, and this isn't really a clue, but it's a prejudice on Agatha Christie's part that can become a clue, that Agatha seems to believe evil is a trait that can be inherited, as does Laura. I suppose for me, the plot weakness is why does, a bit like Letitia keeping the book and photo in A Murder is Announced, why does Robin keep the letters? So the clue is as follows. Robin Underhay, the playwright, is actually the child of a murderer, and that he knows that his mother is a snob, his adoptive mother is a snob. So when you realise that his adoptive mother is a snob and would probably disown him if she knew his real origin, and that he needs her and her wealth to fund his plays, that then becomes the motivation for the murder. It strikes me a little bit like the motive in Crooked House, which is someone wants to do something very badly, which might seem trivial to us, but for them it's very important, and so they will commit murders. So there you are. I find it very well plotted, actually, as a book. I just found it quite hard to read. It didn't sort of move off the page for me. I found it quite stodgy. But it's nothing to do with plotting. I think the plotting is very good. I do, however, find it problematic that Agatha Christie puts so much store by Heredity, and that this is often attached to people who are adopted. Anyway, if you agree or disagree with our take, please feel free to leave a comment on our YouTube channel or join us on the Discord server for Vassals of Kingsgrave. We look forward to discussing these novels with you, and stay tuned next time for They Do It With Mirrors.